Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, I have Joey Cascio on the show. It's been 18 months since he last made an appearance, and he's made many appearances throughout the history of 343. For the uninitiated, Joey has a world of experience, 15 to 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. And not just regular old experience in coaching, like everybody, because everybody can accumulate experience at their job. No, it's a matter of what experience do you actually have and what methodology do you actually have that experience in? Because you can go and show up and lay out cones and do the same thing for 15, 20 years and it's the same wrong thing. Or on the other end of the spectrum, you could be doing the right things for 10, 15, 20 years. So that gives you a good insight into a top-class practitioner. Now, the Club World Cup had just ended. Chelsea obviously beat PSG. It was definitely an unforeseen to global football. Everybody kind of had their money riding on PSG. So, of course, we're going to talk about that too. Speaking about having experience in coaching the right way or coaching the right methodology, what does that even mean? It means looking and studying at how the greats have done it over the course of decades. And there's no other example greater than La Masia. Yeah, sure, some of it you might say there's a lot of marketing associated with FC Barcelona's famed academy, but the proof is in the pudding. And it was never more obvious during the Pep Guardiola era, where global football was taken by storm and he and Barcelona dominated everything using their academy products. And yes, there are cycles, and yes, there are golden generations of players that come through, and yes, sometimes there are dry spells from the academy, but you cannot refute that the way that they trained, and it's not just them, global football in general follows suit, okay? The way that they trained with rondos, the way that they trained with emphasizing possession of the football over the alternative. I mean, what is the alternative to possession? Just playing random jungle ball or bunkering or God knows what, or just playing tactic-less soccer. That is the gold standard, guys. And that is the gold standard that you too can start your coaching journey on or shift your coaching journey at 343coaching.com. There are free programs and there is a premium program. Obviously, the premium program is what's going to get you there, but for those who don't know us very well, you can get started with the free program, get a little taste of who we are, what we do, how we speak, so on and so forth. So I repeat, 343coaching.com. And for parents, you need to be able to mentor and guide your kids as well. You are coaches as well. No, you're not laying out cones necessarily. No, you aren't coaching a team, but you have your kid one-on-one, basically 24/7, 365. So you best believe the way that you communicate with them, the things that you say to them heavily weigh in their development one way or another. For you, I would highly recommend going to 343masterclass.com. We have codified our decades worth of experience in the gold standard for you there, and experience ranging from all the age groups, U9 through U19, up to and including basically a decade's worth of experience of our own in the professional game as well. So we've seen the cycles of players come and go. We know what works. We know what doesn't work. 343 Masterclass is where you want to sign up. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Joey Cascio. Here we go. I got you loud and clear, Joey.
Awesome, man. How's it going?
I'm kind of sad that Chelsea won, but it's fine.
Yeah, why? Because an English team?
Because an English team, number one, and number two, I just like Luis Enrique and I like the way that PSG plays. And I like a lot of the things that Luis Enrique has said over the years. And I just want the guy to be successful, you know, and obviously he is. I mean, come on. But I think maybe it's more not that PSG lost, but more that Chelsea won. It bothers me.
Yeah, I think everybody kind of assumed that PSG were going to run them over just like they've been doing everybody else. They kind of caught him off guard. It was a good game. Interesting game.
Okay, you saw it then.
Yeah, I watched.
Cool, man. The kids are away and Jamie's away for a little while?
Yeah, so they're up in Montana right now. I was up last week. I was in Seattle for ECNL playoffs. And the way it works is for the first round of playoffs, you get to the round of 16. And then if you go to the quarterfinal, it's a whole nother event. So that is next week, and my team qualified. So the plan always was right after Seattle playoffs, I was going to go and meet up with the family in Idaho, and they were going to be up there for like almost 3 weeks, but I had to cut it short and come back home, prepare the team for going to Virginia next week. So yeah, man, they're up there. I'm hanging out solo for this week before I go to Virginia next week.
Cool. So obviously it's going to be a podcast episode, Joey, and people know who you are, but I'm telling you, the last maybe 6 months or so, we have a whole new audience who has come aboard, like a large swath of people who are new to all of us. So I'm going to do a good intro of you, right? And give them a little background that way. So we don't have to do that now, but I know a lot of people are interested in youth soccer. So yeah, give me again. So you were out of state. So you're in Southern California. You were out of state with your Rebels team. What age was it? And it was a group phase sort of thing that you just qualified out of, and then you're going to go to Virginia.
Yeah. So I had the 2010. So they're U15 Rebels in ECNL. And yeah, so they call it the regional round of the playoffs. And yeah, you're in a group of four. And then the winner of the group plays one game, do or die. So it's basically the round of 16. And then if you win that, you qualify to go to what they call the national finals for ECNL, which is in Virginia.
Got it. Quarters, semi, and then final.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. And when is that again?
It starts the 17th. So next Thursday.
All right. Oh man. Okay. So it's this coming Thursday. I've been looking for an excuse to get out of Southern California for a while now. Cause right. I've been traveling to Europe and all over the place constantly, you know, for years now, but this summer it was a low activity summer. So I'm kind of itching to get out. Right. So I'm like, oh, maybe I can go to Joey's thing, but this week is impossible for me, man. Is it streamed?
I think they make you buy a Huddle account. So you have to purchase something. I don't know exactly how it works. It's not free. It's not like it's on YouTube or something, unfortunately.
Bummer. That's a missed opportunity, in my opinion, for ECNL. I mean, they have the funds to be able to just stream the games.
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. Just put it on YouTube. Let whoever watch it and maybe grow the league, grow the brand a little bit.
Hey, what age groups are going to be there in Virginia?
U13 to U17. They are the U19 age group. They've already finished. They had their quarterfinal, semifinal, final while we were in Seattle. So now the remaining age groups are U13 to U17.
Got it. I imagine college coaches galore at this point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 for sure. And there's MLS Academy Scouts and all that good stuff.
Got it. Got it. So what do you think your chances are? I'm not putting you on the spot really, but is it stiff competition? I'm sure you're going to say yes or whatever. What do you think?
Yeah, anyway, I think we have a good chance. We're playing Surf the first game in the quarterfinal. We got matched up against Surf. So a team that we know well. We've played them two times this season, and you know, we have a good chance to beat them. And then, yeah, the other teams I don't know too much about. I typically, what I'll do is as each game approaches, I'll go back and look at film of the team and kind of watch for patterns. So the other teams that are there, there's two other SoCal teams. There's Legends and then there's Beach. So four SoCal teams from our conference advanced to the top eight. And then the other four I don't know too much about. You know, when we move on and we're matched up against them, I'll go and look at the film and try to learn more about them. But I would say in general, I think we got a good chance, man.
Cool. Is that pretty much the same for the other age groups, that Southern California is very well represented?
Usually over the years. Yeah. Like last year, LAFC SoCal, which used to be Real SoCal, they won two national championships across their age groups. San Diego Surf won. But yeah, typically there's a big swath of the Southern California teams representing in the national finals.
Got it. So nothing much has changed for like the past 20 years. It's usually Southern California is like reigns supreme, and maybe like an East Coast club or two or three are regulars as well, but nothing in between.
Yeah. There's Texas too.
Oh, Texas. That's true.
Yeah. I would say, in ECNL, at least, Texas tends to have more representation than the East Coast teams.
Got you.
But yeah, Yeah, man, I took the team to Dallas Cup in the spring, and kind of like looking ahead to potentially in the playoffs, just to try to prepare them a little bit. So that was a good experience. And I think from that, you know, the team took a lot from it, and they feel good. They feel good about, you know, this tournament style competition that we're in for playoffs, because we had to go and win the group. So they were used to it. I think it was good, man. So I've put them in situations this past season, kind of prepped them for this whole thing.
It's been a while since the Dallas Cup final. What do you think it's been? Maybe 4 or 5 months, something like that? I don't know. You can correct me, but I'm think what I want to ask you is, I know there's a lot of turnover in youth soccer, and you know, I would not be surprised at all if there's churn, you know, on your roster. So I'm just curious as to how many in that core group remains with you.
Yeah, so we went to Dallas Cup. It was end of March. So yeah, it's been, what, 3-4 months? And yeah, I would say there's been a couple additions to the team, but the core has remained intact since that run.
Nice. And then you guys are going to have a break after this. How long before you get started all over again?
I usually do 3 weeks, man. I've been doing that for a long time, but with the situation as it is, I kind of play like, okay, if we make it this far, I gave him last week off. So after we finished Seattle, I gave him the rest of the week off. And now once we're done with this trip to Virginia, I'll give him another 2 weeks off, and then we'll get back to it, man, and ramp up for the new season.
Got it. I said I was going to do an intro for you before then, and I will, but very briefly, what position do you hold there at Rebels Soccer Club, which is based out of the San Diego sort of area, and how big is the Rebels Club? So those two things, like how big is Rebels, and then what's your position within the organization, and how long have you been there?
I've been there for 4 years. It's Rebels is growing. It's grown a lot this past year. I think we added like an East County part of San Diego, like chapter to the club. And there was probably 60, 70 teams in that chapter. So we brought in that number to the club. So we're close to 200 teams now at Rebels. And then my position at the club, I coach two teams. I have the 2010s or the U15s. And then I also have the 2013 ECNL team. And then I am the ECNL director for the boys side of the club. So I oversee the ECNL teams, ECRL teams. We're adding another six teams, what they're calling ECRL 2. So they're like making another league within ECNL. And then also our pre-ECNL, which is our U12 and U11 age groups. So I oversee directly 22 teams on the boys side.
Got it. Got it. What a long journey, eh? Joey, how long have you been coaching now? When was your first gig? Do you remember what year that was?
Yeah, it's been crazy, man. Like, I don't know if I've shared this with you, Gary, but I actually started when I was a senior in high school. So at my high school, they did something called like the senior project. Every senior had to like pick something that they did over the course of the school year and just kind of chart their progress and show what they were doing and all that. So and I chose to coach my little sister's rec team. And that's kind of where it all started. So I was 17, 18 years old at the time. And I took a little bit of time off, like after high school. I went and kind of got what, you know, people would say like a normal job, like a 9-to-5 type job. But after 3 years of that, I was like, I want to get back into the soccer thing. So it's been 20 years, man.
20 years. 20 years since that. Whew. 20 years, man. Yeah, it's a long journey, but it goes by quick, doesn't it? Like if I come to you when you're like 20 years old and like, hey, Joe, you tell me, hey, Gary, I'm an ambitious coach. I want to coach. And, you know, I want to get to be a DOC one day or something like this. And I'm like, okay, cool, man. Well, it's going to take you, you know, 15 years, you know, until you get there. Like you would be like, 15 years, fuck that. I'll be fucking ancient when I'm 15 years later, but it goes by so quickly, doesn't it?
Oh, it goes by so fast, man. I can't believe it. And all the places that I've been, like I've kind of jumped around, probably more so than most, you know, youth coaches. I've been, you know, multiple clubs, multiple counties here in Southern California. multiple ages, from rec to MLS academies. It's been a wild run, man. And I still look, I still enjoy doing it. And yeah, man, I don't know. I like the building, the long term. Like, I enjoy that part. Where I think, like you said, most people, it's like, this is going to take years. After whatever reason, I like that. Like, I know that that's the case, and I like that challenge.
Do you still like it, Joey? Like, be honest, though. People want honest answers. Like, I'm honest on the podcast. You know, right? You've been listening to me for a while or whatever, and I don't give a fuck. I'll tell people when, like, things are shit for me, and I question myself, why am I fucking doing this? And I give them all the reasons. So, I mean, maybe you don't have any of those moments, but just share. What come, when I say, do you still love it or do you still like it? What comes to mind?
I mean, of course, there's, you know, the bad shit that comes along with it. But overall, like, I enjoy being on the field, man. I enjoy building on the field, building teams, you know, getting players and building teams and changing the roster and implementing an identity in the team. I love that part of it.
But why? Why?
I don't know. I'm competitive. I'm very competitive. I hate losing. Like, just being on the field is something I really enjoy. Yeah, I don't know. I like that process, going through that process. Because I've started over so many times in my career because I've been at so many different places. And when you go to a new place, yeah, you're starting over. You know, and maybe there's a team already there intact, but in terms of the identity that you want them to play, like, they have no idea what you want. So you're starting over. You have to, you know, communicate your ideas with them and go through that process. And yeah, I don't know, man. I just like that part of it. But of course, there's the bad parts too.
Wait, hold on. Let me interrupt you before I want to interrupt you. There's good stuff here. So before we get back into the what's bad about it, because we can talk about that forever, right, Joe?
Yeah,
The good stuff, like, what would you say if you had to rank these three things? How would you rank them and why? Okay, so whatever comes to mind, would you say that you like the process of building a team most in the beginning stages, in the middle stages, or in the later stages of the team building? So in the beginning, you just got a brand new team. You inherited it or you formed it yourself. That's the start. In the middle, I don't know what you would classify as the middle. Maybe in the middle is 6 months down the line, or the middle is 1 year, 2 years down the line could be the middle, right? And then the end, obviously, a little bit after that. So if you look at those three sorts of phases, because I think there's those three phases, honestly, yeah. And there's clear moments where you're like, okay, I'm in the start, I'm in the middle, or I'm towards the end. What would you like most, or what do you like most, or can you even say?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think the end phase, I would say I like the most, because the first phase, you're eating shit. Because not only are you having to educate the players, you have to educate the parents, and you can deal with a lot of resistance and, you know, difficult conversations. They want to talk to you about this. And, you know, you're trying to create a culture within your team. And the beginning part of that is always the hardest. So that's always the most fun. And yeah, if you don't have sort of that long-term vision, like knowing, like, okay, this is going to take me, you know, 2-3 years to kind of get where I want it to be, or going in the direction that I want it to be, accepting that that's the fact that it's going to take that amount of time. Okay. All right. I'm good with the eating the shit in the beginning part. But yeah, I would say the last phase, and I've kind of seen that with the team that I have now, the 2010s at Rebels, when I first got them, you know, like, yeah, and problems and parents upset, kids left the team, right? Like, they didn't like how I did this or that, and they left. And some of them were good players, important members of the team, you know? So you replace them, you bring new kids in to kind of fill those spots. And I would say last year we were kind of in the middle phase. The team was playing good football, but then there's like a mental aspect of it, you know, trying to make them dogs on the field, which isn't always easy, because you got to have the parents who are kind of helping you with that, because at home they're with the parents, not me. And now this year, yeah, man, it's our first year in ECNL. We qualified for the playoffs. We made the Dallas Cup final, and now we're going to the top eight in ECNL. So I would say this year is kind of like I'm enjoying the fruits of the labor that have gone into it over the past 3 years.
Got it. So you're 3 years deep with this group. So you kind of classified 2 years into it is the middle phase or something like that. Okay. And now you're entering like the final phase is what you're thinking.
Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting because if in theory, let's say you were to have this team for another 2 years and now they're like U17 or something like that, how is 2 years from now? Obviously, that's the final phase, but how is now the final phase also? If that, you know what I mean? It's kind of, I'm thinking, because when people are thinking final phase, maybe they're thinking about maybe it's aging out, but clearly your team is not aging out.
Right. I guess, yeah, there's more to come. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just kind of evaluating the three phases based on what I've already experienced and not necessarily considering what's to come next. But yeah, I think this year couldn't be the middle phase still. You know what I mean? 2 years down the road, I may look back and think this season, well, I think it's the final phase now. It could be the middle phase.
Got you, man. Okay, let's talk about the bad shit. So what comes off immediately off the top of your head? Bad stuff.
Man, we've talked about this, Gary, in conversations. It feels like it's getting more difficult to coach in the youth, and I'm sure other sports youth coaches are experiencing the same thing. It's getting harder from the mental aspect. Like there seems to be, in general, I'd say that there's sheltering of the kids and there's, you know, wanting to blame everything else other than their child or their kid. And with that comes a lot of problems, you know. Parents want to have conversations. They want to know why. Right after games, they want to know why. And it's getting harder, man. And I think when something's not going a player's way, the easy thing is to just up and leave. And that happens a lot more than I've experienced in years past. So, you know, when you're trying to build a team and, yeah, players are up and leaving all the time. And look, it's normal. I think every season, 1, 2, 3 players, normal. But when it's more consistently, yeah, man, it makes it hard to build continuity into your team and, you know, build what you want to build. And I think, yeah, man, there's a lot of that. I feel like I'm on the phone, like nonstop, you know, having these difficult conversations, you know, off the field. It's like, and these conversations happen all hours of the day, right? So it takes a lot of brain power, and any time of the day, we got to try to focus on this and deal with these challenges. And so I think when it comes to that, it's getting harder, man.
Got you. You know, coming at it from a different angle, because we have a diverse audience here as well. I think people would agree or can see what I'm going to say now as well. Teaching, the same thing, right? So I've been teaching at the university level for close to 20 years now in physics, and I regularly have conversations with my colleagues there, other professors there, in particular the department chair, where it's not like we're complaining about the students, but we kind of are, because you look back when you first started teaching 15, 20 years ago, the culture was different, right? The culture of how you study, the culture and quality of the student, who would be admitted to the university, who wouldn't, who would be admitted into an engineering program and who wouldn't, who would be admitted into medical school and who wouldn't. You know, the standards have gotten lower and lower and lower. And if I fast forward to modern day, present day, like students themselves don't even want to read, Joey. They don't even want to open a book and sit alone with the book for hours on end, you know, consistently for an entire semester and then perform. They don't do that. And we all like to, you know, sit here and easily blame social media, but I think there is a truth to that. Yeah. Everybody's in this TikTok culture where it's like a 10 second or 15 second sort of piece of content that they consume. And if they like it, you know, cool, they'll look at the whole 15 seconds. And if they don't like it, they just move on to something else. So imagine if you have to spend, you know, 5 hours there sitting alone with a book, actually reading text, you know, and trying to execute on problems. The culture, the whole mindset has shifted. And it's even gotten to the point where even university kids at times have their parents, or their parents themselves will inject themselves somehow. They will actually email the department or the dean or the professor and say, hey, my kid, this is the situation, you know, what's going on? Wanting to know like what's going on sort of thing. That would never happen in the past. And I can only imagine what it's like at the high school teaching level or elementary school teaching level, because now we're talking youth soccer sort of age levels, yes? Where the parents, I'm sure, are a lot more involved as well. There's a lot more entitlement. There's a lot more of, well, what do you mean my kid is failing? No, he's got a pass. He shows up to school every day. Why is he not passing the class? And there's a lot of parallels there, I guess, is what I'm saying. I just want the audience to imagine, because you guys are teachers too, Joey, coaches. That's how I see it. You guys are teachers. You just teach in the thing that is soccer, right? Somebody teaches history, somebody teaches English, you teach soccer, okay? The difference is you have parents up your ass calling you and text messaging you and emailing you. Imagine if you were a teacher in the academic setting, if that was constantly happening with all of your students. It's a fucking nightmare. You can't work that way. You can't do the job, Joe. Anyway, I thought I'd inject that little tidbit there, because I just think that more people in the audience will relate to it, you know, where it's like, you guys are teachers and you have parents up your ass for all of your players constantly. How the heck can you do your job? Imagine if a math teacher, an English teacher, a history teacher constantly was receiving text messages from parents of their students or emails or phone calls from parents of their students at all hours of the day, all night, on the weekend. And you have to field these things. Otherwise, I don't know, you might have a revolt, you might get fired. They'll talk to the principal, you know, about the teacher and why is my kid, you know, not performing well? The teacher sucks. You know, I want to pull my kid out of the school. That is what you guys are faced with. So I want people to empathize with coaches more often, because you guys don't get the credit you deserve.
Yeah, I know. I mean, obviously I talk to a lot of coaches all the time, and the guys that we have at Rebels, and the feeling, you know, that most of them have is that they're spending more time on those sorts of things than they are, you know, actually focusing on the soccer. So yeah, man, it's very tough, and it is a weird time. Like, I feel like you said, the social media part has injected this different element into all of it. And there's like this currency of attention, and people are, They're like distracted by this attention. They want attention for things that they necessarily haven't really merited, you know, like in soccer, everybody wants to post about how they're doing this and how they're doing. Yeah. They're not going out and actually like putting in the work. They're just, when they see an opportunity to share something online that makes them look like they're important or they're doing something good, they jump on that, but they're not actually behind the scenes putting in the work. And they create this attention for themselves and they like it. But you're not leveling up necessarily. You're just making it look like, you know, there's something good going on there. And there seems to be a huge, you know, like it's a competition for that, like a currency. It's for attention. It's crazy. And yeah, just like, you know, the teachers give homework or tell the kids to study. You know, us as coaches, we tell the kids to be doing this, this, and this on their own. Nearly all of them don't do that. You know, there's a rare few that do, and they seem to be the ones that are elevating themselves.
You're there in the San Diego area, so I know there's a huge Latino demographic, in particular Mexican-American demographic. You're very close to the border, obviously. And you've talked about, you know, the club potentially working a partnership with Cholos in some capacity. It doesn't have to be a formal one. It could be an informal one. But I'm curious as to the club itself. Forget the girls' side. I want to emphasize on the boys' side. What would you say is the demographic split of the club? Would you say it's like, you know, 50% Mexican-American, 50% non-Mexican-American? Is it 20%? Is it 80%? And just give me a general feel.
I would say it's 75% Mexican-American or Latino.
Wow. Wow. Okay. That is significant.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about specific maybe to your team. What percentage would you say watched the Club World Cup final that just finished moments ago?
My team, I would say most of the team.
Most of the team watched it. Gotcha.
Yeah. like over the years, Gary, I have a group chat with him and I'm always telling him like, hey, you guys should be watching this game, or, you know, I'll ask questions about it. I'll get in there. I'll talk shit a little bit, you know, like there's that banter sort of thing between myself and the team. It's just part of our team culture, you know, like, hey, the game's on, we're, you know, everyone's going to watch. And hey, when we get to training, coach is probably going to say something about this or that, maybe talk a little shit, or hey, he might quiz us. So yeah, they have a desire to watch the game. And it's not necessarily because of me. I think also, yeah, it's soccer first households down there for the most part. And yeah, that's what they do. They love football. They watch football.
Awesome, dude. Awesome. No, it's good to hear that, because we share the same experiences of, you know, having coached over 20 years now at this point. Well, I'm not coaching. Brian is the coach, but you know very well how deeply in the mix I was for those 20 years. And our anecdotal experience is the same, Joey, because most of our teams were assembled from that sort of demographic, like the Latino or the immigrant American demographic. And yeah, they all watched soccer. They all watched Liga MX. They all knew all the players on America, all the players on Cruz Azul, all the players on Chivas, when the U.S. men's national team player would play, or the Mexican national team, or they knew what was up. They watched the games. When the, you know, Champions League was on, they were watching. So I bring this up because recently there was somebody on X, right, that wrote, oh, we don't have a soccer culture here. And this is a perpetual theme that's thrown out there. We don't have a soccer culture here. We don't have it. We don't have it. We don't have it. And I ended up posting something that showed a packed stadium, you know, in the game of PSG versus Real Madrid. And it's not just because it's PSG versus Real Madrid that it was a packed stadium. There have been packed stadiums here for soccer forever, Joey, stemming all the way back to the NASL days when Beckenbauer and Pele and all these guys played in the 70s and the early 80s here, packed full-size NFL stadiums. And in 1994, the World Cup, it's still the most attended World Cup in history here in the United States. So anyways, I just posted a picture of the packed stadium and I explicitly said, hey, if you think this is because it's the quality of the football that it's packed, you're wrong. It's just that everybody that's showing up there, they all have a soccer culture of one way or another. And some don't, obviously. They go just for the spectacle, okay? But if you have an MLS game happening right there, or you have a U.S. men's national team game happening right there, it doesn't get filled with 70 or 80,000 people because they don't connect with MLS and they don't connect with a U.S. men's national team. So the point that I'm getting at here is some folks took issue with that and saying that's an exception, right, to the rule. We don't have a soccer culture here, Gary. Just go and ask all your youth players, you know, how many watched, you know, the Club World Cup, or how many watched, you know, the U.S. men's national team or the Mexican national team, and you'll see that nobody watched it. And I'm like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? Like, this particular person I'm thinking of right now lives in a bubble, because I looked into their history a little bit. They coach girls soccer, like in the middle of the country, okay? And he's basically in the bubble of the suburban, quote-unquote, white, upper-middle-class, affluent demographic that is not soccer-first households. And they take that personal anecdotal experience and then they extrapolate it to the whole country. And they're like, we don't have a soccer culture. I asked my girls, you know, who watched the Club World Cup, and not a single one raised their hand, you know? Well, yeah, of course not. You are stuck in that little demographic. So it's good to hear from your end anyway, that basically all your players, you know, if you ask them, watch. And from my 20 years experience, if I ask my teams, all of them would say, yep, of course I saw the game last night.
Yeah, it's interesting. The girls' side of our club, I would say that's how it is. Like, that guy experiences in the middle of the country. I think totally. In general, girls' players don't typically watch games on TV. The boys do, yeah, especially, yeah, outside of that white suburban soccer culture that we have here. The Latino kids, and even beyond that, they're watching, man. They're paying attention. They love it. Like, yeah, for sure. That culture or that demographic that people say, oh, there's no soccer culture, they seem, that aspect of the soccer community here in this country seems to be the one that's always pointed to and spotlighted. But outside of that, yeah, it's totally different. And there's way more communities across the country that there's a big soccer culture in. There's passion there. There's a hunger for the game, but they're not the ones that we see in the mainstream media. You know, they're not spotlighted. So people, yeah, who pay attention to the mainstream media all the time, yeah, you're not seeing any of that.
Yeah. And, or you'll just have experiences like this gentleman, you know, that you're actually a practitioner, but you are a practitioner within a bubble of the non-soccer first households. And the same thing with college, because he mentioned he has experience coaching college or hosting college camps or something like that. College soccer is the suburban affluent, all that shit. It is, college soccer is not the soccer first household demographic.
Yeah.
It just isn't. Most of the soccer first household demographics aren't going to college and playing college soccer. This is just, especially girls, right? No, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I wanted to inject that, but it's also a good segue. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the game, dude. I wanted this conversation to be more like how we, whenever we meet at like Fogo the Chow or something like that, we have a beer and talk soccer. What did you think of the game, dude? First off, who are you rooting for? Because I already ranted that I fucking hate the English. I didn't want the English to win and the English won, so I'm a little upset about it. But yeah, tell me your expectations going in, who you wanted to win. What did you think of the game? Why did it turn out the way it turned out?
Yeah, I'll start with like the tournament as a whole. Yeah, I don't know how I felt about it, man. Like the Club World Cup, I was like, it's this new thing, right? Like some of the teams or some of the players don't seem too happy to be there. So it was kind of a weird feeling. But of course, like once the game started and I'm watching the game, and I love to watch the game, but. So yeah, it was kind of a weird feeling about the tournament. And I went to the PSG Atletico Madrid game, and yeah, that was weird too, because tons of people in the stadium, but there's like segments of the crowd that you could tell like they're passionate about it. But then there's all these other parts of the crowd. People are getting, going to the snack bar, getting hot dogs, nachos, beers. I'm trying to sit there and watch the game. And it seemed like every 5 seconds, someone wants to, you know, walk out of the aisle. So I have to stand up, let them by, sit back down and start watching the game again. Oh, here comes somebody else. I got to stand up again. I was getting pissed, man. I was getting frustrated. But anyways, so the game today, I think, yeah, I admire Luis Enrique too, Gary. I think he's an unbelievable coach. Seems like a good person. I know that he's faced some difficult challenges in his life. Specifically the situation with his daughter passing away. Like he's been through a lot, and I like the way that his teams play. So yeah, I think I was hoping that PSG would win, and I thought that that'd be the case, seeing how that they kind of went through the tournament. But on the other side, Chelsea, yeah, they've turned over players like crazy. So I don't really know what they are, you know, at this point, just because there's been a lot of change. But I was impressed with Chelsea. They played well, and they kind of let PSG have the ball, but they were just trying to kill them on the counter and in transition. And they did that. They did that a few times. And you know, PSG were in a position now where we have to score goals. So it just presented all these opportunities for Chelsea to hit them on the counter attack, and they were deadly, man. Cole Palmer is an English player that I actually like.
Same, yeah, same.
You know, he's different than the, you know, typical English profile. He's look at this scrawny, like he doesn't look like an athlete. You look at him, he's like this scrawny guy, like super skinny, but he's got a little flavor to him, personality. His left foot is special. So I really like him, you know. I did think PSG would come away with it, but didn't go that way, man. But it was a good game. I enjoyed it. What did you think?
Well, I have so many thoughts, dude. So number one is, you know, I always think it's hard to innovate in soccer because the principles are kind of eternal. So it's no secret that we're one of those educators that try to hammer home the principle of possession, holding possession, right? And possession is fundamental to everything, okay? Can you win games bunkering and countering or playing direct? Of course you can. But for the most part, if you're able to have the ball more often and for longer periods of time throughout the game than the opponent, then the probabilities are in your favor that you are going to win. And we don't have to go through all the reasons why, right? But this is something that never changes. It has never changed since the very beginning of football, in my opinion. Certainly since I was conscious and able to watch the game, possession is everything. So that said, I return to the whole thing of being able to innovate something. And Luis Enrique was able to innovate something, apparently. At every single kickoff, he just launches it to the opponent's corner flag. Whereas, you know, all of us who say possession, possession, possession or whatever, and for throughout history, you don't do that. You don't just piss it away. Okay. But the guy was innovative, and it's not that he doesn't believe in possession. It's the opposite. He absolutely believes in possession. And he's like, you know, what's awesome is we want to recoup the ball up there right away and put them under pressure right away. And the easiest way to be in their half and control them in their half is to just fucking throw, launch it over there, have them do a throw in by their own corner flag. Good luck, opponent, trying to get out of that. Cause we train how to press. So that was amazing to watch. It was an innovation. Nobody, yeah. Who has done that, Joey?
No, I haven't seen anybody do that.
And now watch, so many youth teams are going to start doing this. Well, it'll work if you actually train your team. You know, what do you do once they have that throw in over there? How do you press? How right. do you recoup? And once you recoup it, what are we going to do once we recoup it? You have to rehearse that in training. So that is one thing that really stood out to me. I'm like, Jesus Christ, this guy innovated something. I thought it was only Pep Guardiola who was allowed to innovate with, you know, the fullbacks who come in the interior and be central midfielders when in possession and all the other innovations that he came up with. So that was cool. The other thing is, I think it was very clear in particular with the game against Real Madrid, how important pressing is. And that was key to PSG. So you see Dembele, who, in my opinion, in years past, especially when he was in Barcelona, wasn't really a pressing animal. He kind of gave me the vibes of being a lazy sack, like Mbappe is a lazy sack on the defensive side of the ball. But somehow, some way, Luis Enrique has this guy being the most savage pressing machine ever created. Okay. I'm sure you've seen the clip, right?
Staring at the goalkeeper who's getting ready to take the goal kick, like, I'm going to eat you alive.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%, dude. And I think that is 50% of why he'll probably win the Ballon d'Or, is because of that as well. Because it was such a key and crucial ingredient for PSG to be successful. And then on the flip side, you see Mbappe, lazy sack, and not just Mbappe, but Vinicius too. Just, they don't do that. They're just trotting around, and it's everybody else's responsibility to get the ball back. And when they get the ball back, okay, then you feed it to me. They're kind of trying to behave like Messi somehow, I suppose. Maybe, I don't know, but it feels like it's out of an entitlement is the way they do it. Whereas Messi's not doing it out of being entitled. Oh, I'm Messi, I don't need a press. It has nothing to do with that, in my opinion. Yeah. It's more that, no, I'm Messi. I actually know everything that's going on around here. And so I know exactly how, you know, to move myself, how to walk, basically. Yeah. If that makes sense. I don't know if any of that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And that's how I see it too. He's just strategically watching on both sides of the ball, with and without the ball. And there might be moments where he sprints to go defend or press, but it's few and far between. But the moments where he's just standing, it seems like there's strategy to it. He's analyzing what's going on around him, and he's just waiting for the right moment so he's efficient. Or Dembele and Vinny just kind of chilling, and sorry, Mbappe, yeah, their body language says, like, I don't have to do this.
Yeah, and I'll add the other ingredient, that when it comes to Messi, the coach creates an entire team around Messi and Messi's behavior. And that is one of Messi's behaviors. Like, he's not going to go and exert his energy running people down and pressing the goalkeeper and going from one side of the field to the other to press. So they engineer it so that Messi can be effective by just walking around, versus an Mbappe or Vinicius Jr., their coaches aren't being like, oh, okay, you're Mbappe, like, it's cool. Like, don't worry, I will assemble a team such that we recover the ball without you.
There's an interesting data point too, Gary, because Luis Enrique had Barcelona with Neymar, Suarez, and Messi as his front three. And they pressed, right? They pressed. And then Suarez wasn't there. It was Mbappe, Neymar, Messi at PSG. And the team was very unbalanced. So it's like, okay, who's the one that, you know, wasn't at Barcelona before? It's Mbappe. So it kind of leads you to believe that, yeah, Mbappe on the defensive side of the ball creates an unbalance, as good as he is scoring goals. And there's a recent quote from Enrique where he says, like, I'd rather have four guys that score 12 goals or something like that instead of just one guy that scores 40.
Right.
So Mbappe scored goals. He's a killer in the attack and in front of the goal. But yeah, if he's not willing to do the job on the other side of the ball, it creates an imbalance in the team and it makes it very hard to win.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about this thing that's called causation versus correlation? So this is something that I've thrown out there repeatedly over the years, and I wish our school system would teach kids from a very early age this concept of, hey, just because two things seem to be correlated with one another doesn't mean that one is causing the other, right? So for example, there are absolutely classic examples of this. So I think one of it is, you know, if you plot the sale of ice cream throughout the course of the year, and then you also plot on the same graph the amount of drownings over the course of the year, there's a peak during the summer months, right? And so this is an obvious thing that everybody can get. It's like, oh, does consuming more ice cream cause more drownings? You know what I'm saying? Well, no, of course not. It's just that it gets hot, you know, so more people eat ice cream during the summer, and it gets hot, so more people go swimming during the summer. So obviously it's a stupid little example, but there are more convoluted examples. So for instance, if you plot, or if you do a correlation between people who exercise a lot, there seems to be a little bit less heart disease in those people. So, oh, now a lot of people might agree with that. You know, because that makes sense. I've been told the exercise is good for you. You exercise, your heart muscle develops more. It's a little bit stronger. So you don't have that higher risk of heart disease. But you don't look to higher order thinking or reasons. For example, hey, maybe people who exercise more or a lot have much better diets. So the dietary thing is actually the one that helps with heart disease, right? And it's not the actual exercise. And I'm just keeping it superficial here. But these are examples. And, you know, the game just ended, Chelsea PSG, and I see all of the superficial stuff, Joey. Like, oh, now we should, I'm going to crack a joke here. Oh, now we should learn how to play like Chelsea, like Luis Enrique and the PSG way of playing with possession, all this stuff. That's all out the fucking door. It's all about fucking how Chelsea plays. And let's study Maresca. Maresca's a genius. He looked and he saw how Bayern Munich, you know, did against PSG, and he incorporated the same thing, and he didn't sit back like Real Madrid did, and he's a genius now. So the correlation, the causation thing is all fucked up, because just because Chelsea wins doesn't mean Maresca is a genius. Just because Chelsea wins doesn't mean that PSG and Luis Enrique are morons, sort of thing. But everybody jumps to those conclusions. And one in particular, and then I'll hand the mic over, is a comment I saw by Hercules Gomez. And this guy is increasingly losing, like, he cares, but I don't care either, is increasingly losing my respect. Like, just stupid takes left and right, okay? From stupid takes on Pochettino moments ago, you know, last week, and the Gold Cup stuff, to a stupid take right now, which he tries to inject Pochettino again. He's like, oh, look, last two clubs Pochettino was in charge of, you know, PSG and Chelsea, you know, where, you know, he was a failure, he didn't do anything, the clubs were shit or whatever. He leaves, and all of a sudden, you know, Chelsea wins Europa League and the PSG wins the Champions League, and now they're both playing for the final of the Club World Cup. So it's a classic example of being an imbecile and doing correlation versus causation and not understanding that. Or worse, he's just being disingenuous and throwing it out there and being a shit poster and trying to get engagement and not being authentic or genuine.
Yeah, yeah. Man, there's so many factors that go into games. Like, it's impossible to just point to one thing. there's so many things we don't see, we don't know. So yeah, I always thought that was a red flag. When people are doing that kind of stuff or having a take like that, that's a massive red flag, man. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You know, that
I mean, it's so many things, factors outside the game too. Like Pochettino left freaking those two clubs a long time ago. What's the roster turnover been like? You know, was it the same team? Was it not the same team? What is the whole sporting environment there like, right? Has the technical direction, you know, from the board level changed since he's left or since he hasn't left? Even if there hasn't been a lot of roster turnover and the core of the team is still there, okay, well, the team has now been together X number of years more than when Pochettino had them. I mean, the laundry list, we can go on forever as to what could be causing certain things. So it's just this sort of quote-unquote analysis that drives me crazy, Joey, because we need the American soccer fan, supporter, coach, you name it, we need them to level up.
Yeah.
We need them to level up. And when you have this sort of punditry or journalism or whatever it is you want, media personalities out there saying stupid shit, it doesn't level up the fan base. It makes them dumber.
Yeah.
I get riled up, Joe.
Yeah, no, me too. I didn't see his post right after this game, but, you know, I see a lot of that stuff. It drives me nuts, man. Like, they're not practitioners. They're in the trenches, operating in the trenches, like the people that they're commenting on. And it would be nice, you know, if more practitioners or people operating in the trenches were giving the commentary. So the perspective that they would share would be totally different, in my opinion, as opposed to these guys who, you know, they sit on the media. That's what they do. They're just on the media. They're creating, you know, their idea and opinion based on what they see. And they have no idea what's really going on. But the practitioners, the coaches, the staff members, yeah, they can't go out necessarily and always share their opinions.
And even the ones that do, like when they're, say like a Mourinho, remember when Mourinho was not coaching for a while and he, you know, was invited on to do some commentary or analysis or punditry? Very good, obviously. Awesome. I like listening to him. You could tell that there's an obvious deeper richness of expertise coming out. But I think Mourinho and people like him are an exception because not only is he a practitioner, but he's a world-class practitioner, a proven world-class practitioner that doesn't need the favors of anybody, you see? So he can come out and really give it a go with his deep subject matter expertise. There are other practitioners who have been practitioners and then go into this sort of media space or environment. But since I speculate now, venturing into speculation, but it's informed speculation, okay? Since they know that they suck at the craft, at the practice of coaching, of whatever it is, they're trying to find a way either to get back into it somehow, that somebody will give them another chance or another job or another shot, or they're trying to shift careers, or they're trying to keep their options open for their livelihoods. And so they're incapable, right, of one, perhaps speaking all their truth, because there's a lot of feeling that, what's that word that I'm looking for? A huge level of imposter syndrome. Like they know that they're an imposter. They know that they suck. So it's kind of like they're scared. How about that? They're just scared of saying certain things. And so they play it safe, number one. Or two, they're trying to do somebody or get in the good graces of somebody. So for example, I want to get a job in MLS, let's say. Okay, well, I'm not going to give you my opinion on MLS. I'm going to keep it nice. I'm going to say MLS is, oh my God, the best league in the history of the United States, 30 years running. It's got 30 bloody teams. Look at the valuations of the teams. Everything's amazing. Look at the transfers that we've done to Europe in recent years, like blah, 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 blah. Like lubing somebody up, you know what I'm saying? So that I can get in the door. So it's not always that a practitioner has good opinions or punditry either. We have to be careful.
Yeah, true. No, Mourinho is a good example, man, because everywhere he's been, like, he's not afraid to come out and say stuff against, you know, maybe the club that he's at. And I think right now in Turkey, he's fighting against the Turkish Federation and going to war with them and like implying that things are corrupt and Galatasaray, like they benefit from this corruption in the Federation. And yeah, he doesn't give a shit. And that's awesome. You know, like he's just real. He's just himself. And you can sort of tell, you know, like Mourinho obviously is different. And for me, he's one that, okay, I want to listen to this guy. I want to know what he has to say. I want to know his opinions. And then, you know, there's all these guys here in American soccer media and they say what they say. It's like, yeah, I don't really care what, you know, your opinion is, because you can kind of feel and tell what you're talking about, that they're saying what they need to say to be accepted in the little bubble that they're in.
It's like, there's a huge difference between Mourinho and, you know, say a Landon Donovan. And Landon Donovan, who has obviously been a player, but he also coached, I think, two seasons, the San Diego Loyal. He coached two seasons in the USL. So that's a professional thing, but there's a massive difference. I mean, 2 years ain't shit in coaching, Joey.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you play it and you were one of the best American players. Playing and coaching are two worlds apart, two whole different animals, two whole different skill sets. So if you think back to after 2 years of coaching, how much you knew, right? And all the details and nuances, it's a joke. Yeah, it's an absolute joke. You know nothing.
You know nothing.
You know absolutely nothing. So, okay. Along the same lines. So we talked about the culture of the players, the youth players. Did they watch pro games? Do they not watch pro games? You're probably living in a bubble if all your players don't watch games, because clearly my bubble, all my players watch the games. Your bubble, all your players watch games as well. How about the coaches? Because in my opinion, it's important for coaches to be watching football, right? I'm curious, in your experience, you don't have to keep it to Rebels, what percentage of youth coaches would, in your experience, don't extrapolate it, in your experience, what percentage of coaches watch games? And significantly, not just once in a while, oh, look, the World Cup is on, I'm going to watch the World Cup. Nah, like they watch.
Yeah, I would say at most 50%.
Yeah.
At most, maybe even a little less than that. I couldn't imagine like someone that operates in youth soccer, you're a coach, not watching football, man. Like any chance I get, I'm watching. Whether it's, yeah, like the Club World Cup, some of the best clubs in the world, Champions League, the domestic leagues in Europe, South American football. And even here, you know, I'll watch MLS as much as I can't stand watching MLS and think it's terrible. I'll watch because my opinion is that, hey, I operate here in America. I need to understand what it looks like, what's going on in MLS and also USL. I'll try to watch USL games too. I couldn't imagine not watching football as a youth coach. It seems insane to me, but yeah, I enjoy the coaches that are constantly watching football, man.
Would you say it's like a requirement or a necessity and why or why not? Like does it help you, right? Obviously, you're going to say yes, but like expand on that.
Yeah. What you're trying to do with your teams, you know, you pick up little things along the way, the more football that you watch. My eye for the game has evolved and improved over time as I've watched games. I like to think that the more games I watch, the better my eye is, you know, when I'm out working with the kids or we're in the middle of a game and, you know, maybe there seems to be a problem and I have to try to find a solution to the problem. My ability to be able to do that, I think, improves over time, the more football that I watch. And then obviously there's the cultural differences, you know, South American football as opposed to European football or American football. They all have different flavors. And yeah, as a coach here, picking up on little things from different cultures and applying it here, it's going to help you with your work here. I couldn't imagine, man, not watching football, being a youth coach. I think that's crazy. It's a disservice to the players that you're working with.
Yeah, but you're saying but in your estimation and in your bubble, you're saying like 50% don't really watch.
Yeah, and Rebels, I would say maybe that's the club where the most of the coaches watch. But over time, over my career, the different places that I've been, yeah, I'd say about 50%. And then there's like the different extents. Like I'm crazy. I'm watching it all the time. Any chance I get, there's a few other coaches like me at Rebels, and there's others, you know, hey, maybe I got this going on today, so I can't watch that. And, you know, maybe I'll watch a game this weekend or, you know, when they have time, you know,
it's casual.
Yeah. More casually.
Is it because it's not their careers, or would you say that there are like career coaches where it's their main livelihood that are also not watching?
Yeah, I think that there's some where it's their career and they watch it casually. They're not watching it all the time. Like,
would you also say that maybe is it because they don't have buddies who watch it? Because there's something to that too, right? If you have a group of close-knit friends that are also colleague coaches or in the profession one way or another, that camaraderie kind of compels you to keep watching too, because you don't want to be like left behind somehow. Yeah. You don't want to be the guy who doesn't watch soccer.
Yeah, for sure. No, yeah, when we're on the field working, we talk about it. So there's definitely that aspect to it. But yeah, then no, there's career coaches that I've seen that just watch it casually, man.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Imagine like this is like your job and you're like, meh.
Like, yeah. And I prefer to watch it by myself, to be honest.
No, totally. Same here, man. Same here. The World Cup final, Argentina versus France, dude. People hit me, hey, let's watch the game. Like, do you know who I am? Like, I don't watch games with people. Like, what's wrong with you? Like people who know me for a long time have even said that. I'm like, bro, maybe you're just being nice and you want to include me or something, but I'm not watching the game with you. I locked myself in the garage and that's where I watched the game, Joey. I went to the garage just so I wouldn't be disturbed by my girl or the dogs or anything like that.
That's for Argentina games. But like when you were Champions League or stuff like that, do you do the same?
I prefer it, but sometimes it's hard to get away. As I'm sure you know, you have a family and stuff, so I can't get away sometimes. But every time that there's other people in the room with me, I can't concentrate the way I want to concentrate. And if I can't concentrate, I don't enjoy it as much.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I think that's sometimes the struggle, because I don't know about you, but when I watch a football match that I am interested in, yes, I'm watching it for entertainment as well, but there's just a whole other side of me that's not just watching it for entertainment. There's something deeper to it, whether it be an emotional thing, but that's also entertainment, but maybe it's just a technical thing, right? That I'm just looking at. Don't get me wrong. I'm not looking at, oh, what system of play is he playing? What system of play? Oh, where's the tactical sound? I'm not doing that either, but I just can't pinpoint it. It's not just me having a good time. Let me put it to you that way.
Yeah. I'm the same. I'm curious as to how each team's going to approach the game, but yeah, I prefer to watch on my own. I'm the same. Little distractions take away from my experience of watching the game.
Can I say something else? Because so many people draw conclusions, like right now, PSG, Chelsea, everybody tweets immediately, you know, at halftime or immediately at the end of the game. This is what's happened. This is what's happening. This is the tactical blunders or, you know, all that stuff. And I'm looking at them like, either you're an outrageous Mourinho level genius that sees things, but I don't see any of this stuff, right? For me, it's kind of like, for the biggest part of the game, for the details, I'm blind. I'm blind to the details. If I wanted to really dig into it, I would have to watch the game again, put on the hat of breaking down what's going on, and probably have to pause the game and rewind and relook at things a lot to really deconstruct, to have a hope of getting into the mind of Luis Enrique as to what he might be doing or not doing. You know, but in the live action, as the game's going on, I can't get into the mind of Luis Enrique to see what he probably did in preparation for this game. Yeah. There's no fucking way.
Yeah. I personally don't pay attention to those people that break down games like that. Like you, I don't watch a game like that. That's not how I watch a game. I like the personality I'm watching the players, their personality, like, you know, the play in the PSG Chelsea game, like Cucurella was winding some of them up, and Joao Neves snapped and pulled his hair, And you could kind of see Cucurella, like it was boiling, right? It was boiling up, and it got to a point where, yeah, he reacted and did something, and all right, you're off the field. And you tried to like help him up, like, hey, get up at one point. And Cucurella was like, no, I'm staying on the ground. Didn't want his help to get up off the ground. I like watching that kind of stuff throughout the game.
Yeah.
Or yeah, Cole Palmer, like, well, what's he going to do? But yeah, these like tactical analysis things. Yeah, I don't know how you just see that from just watching the game in live time.
I don't know if they believe their own bullshit or they know that they're bullshitting when they put this stuff out there.
Yeah, maybe, man. I don't know.
Hey, I wanted to add to your reasons as to why coaches should watch also. The other huge component, in my opinion, is when you watch so much for so long and so deeply, you accumulate a reservoir of stories, right? And then you tap into that reservoir and whip out a story to your team or to an individual player on your team or to parents or whoever, right, your audience is, you have a reservoir of stories to teach them things from and to give them lessons from. You know, maybe it could be the historical trajectory of a player that you can just whip out of your ass. You know, like James Vardy. I'm just saying James Vardy because everybody knows James Vardy and they all know that story because obviously that became a huge story. Look at James Vardy. If you want to talk about late bloomers or people who didn't make it and they were toiling in the 8th division of England while working a part-time job, you know, being a bartender or whatever, and he became, you know, Premier League champion, English national team. Like, you can whip out stories that aren't high profile like that necessarily at will. And then that gives you so much credibility, Joey, with everybody involved. And that is a huge part of coaching because it helps you get buy-in from everybody.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you as a youth coach, you know, you're supposed to be an expert in teaching the game. And when you have all of that at your disposal, you sound like an expert. You know, you're giving information like an expert. It helps, yeah, credibility 100%. Helps earn the respect of the players, and especially with the boys, because they watch, a lot of the boys players watch. You know, if you have all of those stories that you can pull out, yeah, man, you're going to earn their respect for sure.
Even more if it's coupled to their culture. So if we have like Mexican-American kids or parents or whatever, and we could just whip out stories about Cuauhtémoc Blanco or Luis Hernandez or all that sort of stuff, it's like instant credit. Well, Jesus Christ, this guy knows more about the soccer of my heritage than I do. And I thought I knew a lot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I'm obviously not Latino. So maybe that's another reason why I feel the need to continue to watch games because, and this has happened to me, Gary, I've gone into teams where it's predominantly Latinos. And yeah, at first they don't respect me because who's this guy? You know, like he's not Latino. He probably doesn't know anything about football.
Yeah, yeah. So
having those stories, yeah, it helps 100%, especially in my case with that situation.
Yeah, and that's why I've always lobbied for a foreigner to be the U.S. men's national team coach, like a Jurgen Klinsmann, like a Pochettino. It's related to that because they have international experience at the highest levels, not only of just playing, but of coaching. And they can whip out stories. I'm not talking about whipping out stories for their players and gaining credibility with their players. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about using the microphone that is the national team coach podium and whipping out stories and educating the American soccer ecosystem, American soccer fan base. And elevating and having the credibility to do that with, because a Greg Berhalter or a Peter Vermes or a Jim Curtin, you know, all those sorts of MLSC guys or whatever, they can't get on the podium and start, I don't want to say lecturing, but educating the American soccer fan base about international global football, right? And leading them there.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck do they know? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, okay, you may have played at the international level with the national team, but that you've never managed PSG with Neymar and Messi and Mbappe and all these guys. You never managed Chelsea or Tottenham or Real Madrid, or you can't talk like this, you know? And you don't have, you're local. You're not German. You're not Argentinian. You're not Brazilian. Like, you don't speak the language. You can't connect on that level. So that's why I've always advocated for these guys to have the podium here. But these fucks don't like it, Joey.
Yeah, they don't like it. I mean, I've seen people criticizing Pochettino like they know what the fuck they're talking about, man. It's like, you're nuts. And when I see Pochettino, it's like my general perspective is like, okay, what you say carries far more weight than what Berhalter would say when he was up, you know, in the press conferences talking or in an interview. But yeah, there's people here, the public here, some of them, who criticize Pochettino just like they would criticize Berhalter. And in my opinion, it's completely different. Like you just pointed to, this Pochettino's coached in multiple European countries, some of the best players in the world. Like, his experiences far outweighed Berhalter's experiences, for example. And they give opinions on the two guys like they're the same level. It's crazy.
You're right. I didn't think about that. Maybe they just got used to criticizing Berhalter and they learned a new skill and they're deploying that skill.
Yeah. Or going, it's the currency of attention thing. They just want the attention.
Right. And look, you're the same as I am, I think. We're not about pedigree. Oh, look at this guy coached here, coached there, played here and played there. And then that gives you the credibility automatically. No. Understand that I watched Pochettino play. Okay. Understand that I've watched Pochettino coach at all his clubs. I've gotten a little bit of a pulse of him during his club coaching career. It's not me saying, oh, this guy's coached here, and played here. He's a genius. No, I don't think about that at all. I don't look at it that way at all.
Yeah. It's not just the title. It's the body of work, like observing some of the body of work and knowing that the person, okay, this person knows their shit.
Yeah. Not just typing on Wikipedia to see what his record was at Tottenham or what his coaching record was at Chelsea or what trophies did he win? You know, we're not relying on that, Joey. We're relying on actually having watched and studied.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. This is a classic thing of Bielsa. When people say, oh, Bielsa is a genius, or right, I say Bielsa is the best in the world and all this sort of stuff, the immediate response is almost always of the Americans here. It's like, this guy hasn't even won a title.
Yeah. You clearly don't know Bielsa's body of work very well. He chooses not to go to the best teams.
Yep.
It seems like he likes like mid-table clubs where there's like a serious connection, you know, between the community and the club, the job opportunities that he takes. It's fascinating. But yeah, if you're not watching and paying attention to the work, then you have no idea.
You look up Wikipedia or Transfer Market and you look at the numbers on the screen, the tables, the different tables, and try to draw some conclusions from the tables. And that's where you get your opinion from.
Yeah. No clue.
You think those people who are saying that stuff nowadays, the 20 somethings or the people, you know, people in that sort of age group who just turned on to MLS or the US men's national team, you think they watched Bielsa, Athletic Bilbao versus Manchester United? You think they watched that game?
No chance.
That was epic.
Yeah, that was Europa League. A lot of people don't watch the Europa League. It's the Europa League. Like, it's stigma's like, it's below the Champions League. Why am I going to watch that?
But that was an epic war, bro. Yeah, that was amazing.
Great. Yeah, Sir Alex Ferguson, Bielsa. Like, I remember that, man, because I've always followed Manchester United. Incredible.
I'm gonna speculate something here.
Yeah.
About Bielsa, okay, and what you said about, you know, him getting mid tier teams or lower tier teams, and as to why that might be the case. I have no idea. Okay, obviously only he knows. But there's like a principle that I'll draw an analogy. So if you're a student and you're getting an F, okay, it's a lot easier to go from an F to a C, right, than it is from going from a C to an A, right? Because going from an F to a C, you don't, I mean, just fucking do the bare minimum, basically, you know, and you'll get your ass there. And then C to a B, okay, you got to do a little bit more than that. But then the curve, right? The curve is a slope that's steep and then it tapers off. It's an asymptote. You know what I'm saying? Because yeah. Once you're out of 100 percentage points, if you're at 98%, for you to get your score, your average score, you know, with all your other scores, for you to improve that one more percentage points or two more percentage points, it's almost impossible. You see, it's like Luis Enrique at PSG. For him to get his team to be even better than it is now, that is a completely different skill, or even a possibility. Maybe it's not possible, right? Versus getting somebody like, I don't know, Monaco to win the French League, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or get the worst team in France, get them to be mid-table. Really hard, don't get me wrong, really hard. But going from a 70 to an 80% is easier than going from a 98% to a 99%.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought of it like that.
Like if you, Joey, in youth coaching, if you get, and this is interesting because it relates to our coaching program and courses, and people who tell me, oh, Gary, will this work? Because my team is not like yours. My team is like shocking. They're lower level. Like, can they possess? The answer is absolutely. It's actually easier for you to improve your team if your team sucks. You know what I'm saying? If your team is not great or not the best and doesn't have the best players, it's easier to improve them versus getting a team that already has all the cracks on
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A team who has all the fucking best players or what, to get them to operate even better, that's harder.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's completely different skill.
Interesting. I don't know. I just came to mind. I wanted to spit it out there.
Yeah, no, that was interesting. I've never really viewed it like that, man.
Like how much, because your team right now that you are 3 years deep, your 2010s, is that
yeah.
what it is?
Yeah,
2010. Like when you first got them, the level of improvement after year one was probably really noticeable. It's like from here to here, I don't know.
Yes.
But from how you have them now, to get them to be even better, it's a different skill set and it's harder.
Yeah. 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 I think in year one, obviously, the identity, the team identity of how they play, they went through a transformation that improved significantly. Now that we have this identity in place, yeah, it's about maybe noticeable improvements, you know, for the untrained eye. And then it's like more the mental part, like having these kids become dogs on the field and not just like, okay, yeah, we're happy playing this way. So it's different. It's a different skill set at this point, and trying to train them to be what I feel with, at least on the boys side, a lot of these boys, they're exactly that. They're little boys. They're not men. And if you're going to be a high level player, you basically have to be a man at the age of 14, 15 years old, like mentally, and be prepared for the things that you're going to have to face. And so I think, yeah, once you have all the good players, teaching them that part, that's hard, man. It's a different skill set.
It's fascinating. Have you been, I won't keep you much longer, have you been tracking Brian's work with AV Alta at all?
I drove out there, man, a few weeks ago. I went to a game. And I've been trying to watch as much as possible on ESPN Plus. So, yeah, I've been watching. And interesting, like, first year team, like, freshly put together. And the way that they're playing, like, you can see the identity that Brian's had with all of his teams, you know, that I've observed over the years. They've already got that. It's crazy. Amazing. Amazing to watch.
Yeah, it's crazy to see, because every time you get a new team, youth or now he's obviously coaching at the professional level, you always wonder, or there's always that question of like, how long is it going to take to establish the structure and establish the identity and then build from that solid foundation? And I've always told youth coaches, because it depends on your skill set as a coach. How good are you as a coach? How experienced are you? Have you done this before? All those factors. I've always said, hey, man, you have to at least give it 6 months before you can sit on the sideline watching a match of your team and you're like, oh, shit, look, they're building.
Yeah.
They're holding. They have the concept. There's something there that we can build on. Some people can do it quicker, and some people will take longer than 6 months. It might take a season or two seasons even. But it was interesting to see Brian, right, starting from scratch at the professional level. And in the beginning, a little bit of some rocky results. You know, he was always dominating possession from almost from day one.
Yeah.
Joey, which is pretty interesting in and of itself, even against USL teams and even against FC Dallas, right? In control of the ball. But now he's had a streak of what, 10 unbeaten games and stuff. And just, you have the ball. You have it. Look, guys, that doesn't guarantee a trophy, right? As you just saw Luis Enrique lose the Club World Cup. Okay. But the probabilities of being successful are increased, man. So I don't know. That's what I have found intriguing.
For him to be able to do that at the professional level and that quickly that's impressive, man. And the players, I now I'm interested to see the individual talent, like how they improve themselves because they're within this identity now, this team identity. And that usually is the case, right? The individual improves a little bit because, yeah, there's this clear identity and everybody, you know, on the field knows how, you know, we're going to play and the rhythm and the timing of all of it. And yeah, the individuals become better from that.
You know, what's also interesting, Joe, is once you have an established identity and the structure and the foundation is there, it's easier to then identify what players on your roster in each position are just not a good fit and ineffective. And so it's easier, in my opinion, to identify these are the positions that we need help in.
Yeah, I agree.
If it's random, then it's hard to pinpoint. Like, I actually don't know, Joey. Like, if you play random soccer, like most in the country, you just throw out 11 players. Like, how do they go about thinking, oh, I got to cut this player and get this other player? Like, how do you know that?
I don't know. That's a good question. Like, when I watch games where the teams are, it just seems like it's random. I didn't think the players are that good. Because you're not getting a good understanding of like their ability to time things correctly or have that rhythm within the team. There's really none of that. So it's like, how do you know how good the player really is? But yeah, you put them in an identity where that's all going on and they're either fitting in with that or not. And you get a better idea of how good they are. Yeah. And when I watch games and it's just random, it's chaos. It's like, oh, everybody sucks. Yeah. It's a turnoff.
Any other thoughts, ideas, remarks, things that you thought we were going to talk about?
No, I mean, I didn't have any expectations. I just figured, like we always do, man, when we meet up in person, we just shoot the shit, talk, whatever topic comes up. So, no, nothing else on my mind, man. I'm off to Virginia next week, and hopefully I come back and we can talk about a national championship next time, man.
I moved to a new place, so I'm hoping to kind of set up like a mini studio here. So I can have people in person. So you can come over and like have an in-person sort of recording. I think it's a lot better.
Yeah, that'd be badass, man. That'd be badass. It's always good, better conversation, in my opinion, when we're at the bar in person, for sure.
Totally. This kind of sucks. This is like 10% of the goodness of when we're in person.
Yeah. I agree, man. I agree.
Okay, Joey, where can people find you?
Instagram. Just my name, Joey Cascio. Cascio spelled CASCIO.
Brilliant, brother. Good luck. I hope you win. It probably stung a little bit when FC Dallas came back in the second half and won Dallas Cup, right?
Yeah, we talked about it. I told you, like, my guys are just dead. And FC Dallas was playing at home, essentially. And they had 25 guys on their roster that they could just move in. And if someone was exhausted or hurt, you know, hey, we'll bring in this guy to replace him. Me, I travel with 18 guys, you know, because of course the parents are paying. And if they feel like we may not play that much, why are we going to spend all that money? So I brought 18 guys and two of them were goalkeepers. So by the time we got to the final, we were just dead, man. I mean, we did everything we could. We fought, but yeah, they did a good job. FC Dallas did a good job. It was painful, you know. A lot of benefits that came from it. A lot of positives that came from it, for sure.
Brilliant, brother. Thanks for doing this, man. We should do it more often. Yeah, I don't know. Last time you were on, it was maybe like, I don't know, 6 months, a year ago. I have no idea.
I think it's been a couple of years, Gary.
Holy shit.
I think so, man. It's been a while.
So ever since Benny started helping out, you haven't been on. Yeah. I want to figure out, I don't know, maybe the audience can chime in if you've hung on this long. We're approaching an hour and a half. I kind of want to remove myself from the picture sometimes. Like, hey, Benny, you go fucking talk to somebody. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe you two can shoot the shit. Cause sometimes I feel like I just get in the way.
I don't think
I so. I go off on my rants. You know what I'm saying? And then people just have to listen.
Yeah. But I think the rants are good, man. But what about like three? Have you ever done you and then two other guests?
Good point, man. Good point. We should experiment with that.
Let's do it.
Okay. After you're done with the tournament, dude, we're going to do an experimental three-way.
Okay. Sounds good, man. We'll do it.
All right, brother, man. Good luck.
Yeah.
Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Thanks, dude. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.